This is a rain replay.
This is the rain report. I'm Hap Holly, KCNRP. Radio astronomy is something that I know very little about, and I suspect a lot of you, my listeners, don't know a whole lot about either. We hear about the giant antennas and dishes that are pointing up in the sky, looking for life in whatever form, who knows where. One guy who's really involved in radio astronomy is Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, Dean of Faculty and Professor of Physics at Princeton University, recipient of the 1993 Nobel Prize for Physics for his work on pulsars.
The history of radio astronomy, of course, is a great one to talk about in a context that also involves ham radio, because the real originator was a ham radio operator, W9GFZ, Grote Reber. These things happened back in the early to middle years of this century. An actual beginning was marked with some experiments done by a radio engineer known as Carl Jansky in the middle 1930s, working for Bell Laboratories, actually right here in New Jersey, studying the sources. He wanted to understand the sources of the various kinds of noise which interfered with transatlantic radio telephone communications, which were of great interest to the telephone company, of course, during those years. We were in a period of rapid expansion of the need for long-distance communications. Cables were not yet available in sufficient number. Shortwave radio obviously was one way of making the communication circuit across the pond to Europe from North America, but the reliability of those channels was not up to telephone company standards, and it would be important to at least understand the sources of noise with which the signals were competing in order to understand whether this was a viable mechanism for having a regular telephone system. Jansky discovered that in addition to noise from nearby thunderstorms and another kind of slightly different statistical properties of noise from distant thunderstorms much farther away and sort of not so localized, he discovered there was a third source of noise in addition to the thermal noise from the equipment itself caused by a noise background in the sky, obviously coming from outside the immediate environment of the Earth and therefore coming from somewhere else in the galaxy. And in fact, he identified the major maximum in the direction of such noise as coming from the direction of the center of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. Not too long after that, the Second World War intervened, and around that time as well, W9GFZ became interested in what Jansky had been doing and built his own radio telescope in his backyard and out in Illinois, was able successfully to pick up the radio noise that Jansky had been talking about, did some studies of it with respect to directions in the sky and radio frequency. He actually first estimated that the best frequencies at which to detect radio noise from this putative source in the sky would be quite high, so he built VHF receivers during late 1930s, early 1940s. To attempt to do this, but without success at first, so he kept going lower in frequency until finally he found the noise, and the noise turns out to itself have a rather steep spectrum so that it's much stronger at lower frequencies. At any rate, after the war, of course, there had been very significant developments in radar and other kinds of radio frequency technology, so there were many better and more suitable avenues for pursuing the beginnings of discovery of signals from the astronomical universe at radio frequencies that could be followed up in those post-war years. It turns out that the principal interest at first did not happen in this country. The countries that with major activities in the field of radio astronomy first were Australia, Britain, and the Netherlands, in large part in all those cases, well, at least in the case of Britain and Australia, as a result of wartime work on radar, localization of enemy planes and things like that led to some of the same technology required. And the Dutch, actually, I think, were just quick to catch on to the potential for making real scientific gains here and had the advantage of some abandoned German radar equipment they could put to work doing these kinds of studies in those post-war years. The attractiveness of the possibilities of doing astronomical research with telescopes that were sensitive to radio waves instead of telescopes sensitive to light waves did also soon become recognized in this country, and major efforts were put into building sizable radio instruments for astronomy starting in the middle 1950s and thereafter. That, of course, was a time at the height of the Cold War when a space race was on and money was available for scientific research of these kinds, and the country put considerable effort into it at that time. That was about the time, of course, that I was becoming an adult myself and thinking of research possibilities, and I think those things were attractive to me at the time.
What wavelengths are you dealing with primarily as a radio astronomer?
Great question. Most radio sources have actually fairly broad spectra. You can characterize them by a spectral index. You say that the spectrum varies in proportion to frequency raised to some power, and the power tends to be of the order of minus one or thereabouts. So signals tend to get weaker at higher frequencies, but not all that rapidly. Pulsar signals in general are most readily detectable between frequencies of a few hundred up to a few thousand megahertz. So it's basically VHF and UHF, but not ultra UHF or microwave frequencies for pulsars. Stars themselves generate some radio noise. That, too, tends to be relatively easy to detect at frequencies of anywhere from the upper range of the HF spectrum up into frequencies of a gigahertz or thereabouts, and the signals get weaker if you go higher than that. There are other kinds of radio astronomy that are particularly well adapted to work at much shorter wavelengths. And so the country has actually put quite a bit of research and development effort in the last 10 or 15 years into millimeter wavelength, both the technology for low noise receivers and the technology for very precise antennas to be used at wavelengths of only a few millimeters. So most of my own work involved wavelengths down into the a few hundred megahertz up to a few gigahertz, somewhat less so at rather higher frequencies.
How do you cope with the man-made noise that is so prevalent today in urban areas as a radio astronomer?
Well, most radio telescopes are built in a pretty remote part of the countryside, and it depends on frequency, but partly at the very short wavelengths, one wants to be above the most disturbing parts of atmospheric water vapor, and therefore mountaintop locations may be helpful. In other regions of the spectrum where man-made radio interference may be the problem, it helps to be in a valley in a mountainous region so that you get some natural shielding from the surrounding hillsides.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, Dean of Faculty and Professor of Physics at Princeton University. We're talking about radio astronomy. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
There are other criteria as well, however. The Arecibo radio telescope, the big 1,000-foot diameter fixed spherical reflector that is located in the northwestern corner of Puerto Rico, is there for two reasons. One, because the nature of the construction of that instrument required finding a natural hole or depression in the ground of roughly the right size. And that particular region is so-called karst country, as the geologists refer to it. It's full of sinkholes that are created in the natural, very limestone-rich terrain there by the heavy tropical rainfall falling and dissolving the limestone underground, creating large underground caves, which then eventually, over geological timescales, collapse and form these sinkholes. So the telescope is built in one of those natural sinkholes that happens to be about 1,000 feet in diameter, just the right shape for a bowl-shaped telescope. The other reason that telescope is built there is because close to the equator would be good for the purposes it was designed for. It's far enough south that the planets and moon are mostly in view all the time, more or less straight overhead, and it has access to the maximum amount of sky that way. But other telescopes for radio astronomy are built in other regions depending upon the particular criteria that are trying to be optimized. The National Radio Astronomy Observatory is located in the hills of West Virginia, quite far from the heavy population centers and high densities of transmitters and other kinds of radio interference. In fact, there's a so-called National Quiet Zone around the Green Bank, West Virginia area in which it requires some extra surveillance before FCC licenses are granted for fixed transmitters in the area. They basically have to be at least located on the opposite side of a mountain from the observatory in order to keep the radiation levels low in that area. The big telescope in West New Mexico, the big array that has often been featured in popular movies and other places, is built there because a large, fairly dry area of flat ground is needed to allow the individual 85-foot diameter radio telescopes to be laid out in the proper configuration along a railroad track that allows them to be moved to optimize their reception patterns.
How many are there?
There are 27 in that particular arrangement.
Wow. That had to be an amazing construction project in itself.
It is indeed. And many of the same design criteria are used as would be used, say, when creating an array of VHF Yagi's to be stacked and used for very sensitive weak signal work on, say, on 2 meters or 432 megahertz. Many of the same equations have to be used, the same kinds of design goals and criteria. Again, there are trade-offs to be made that would lead to choices such as the use of many smaller units, as is true in that New Mexico radio telescope, or one very big one, as is used in the Arecibo radio telescope. The same kinds of design choices and selections are made by hams when deciding whether to put up one gigantic Long Yagi or to stack a bunch of smaller ones.
Joe, what are you listening for?
The menu of options is almost endless, it seems, and it depends upon exactly what interesting questions are that a particular researcher might be trying to address. My own interest had to do with the study of pulsars, the objects which are left over when certain very high-mass stars explode near the end of their evolutionary cycles. But other radio astronomers have interests that include the formation of stars, understanding of the dynamics and formation of galaxies, where planets fit into the whole picture, how our whole Milky Way galaxy fits together to form an evolving spinning disk of matter, which is spread out very thinly, but which somehow has given rise to at least a few places where dense things form on which people can live, the planets, and other things form which lead to the other evolutionary processes that generate, starting out with nothing but hydrogen, all the heavier elements in the chemical tables. We now have a pretty good picture of how that works, and that somehow creation began at a stage where most of the kinds of things that we deal with in everyday life, made of the heavy elements, the metals, carbon, and so forth, that are so prevalent on Earth, don't yet exist, and that those have been cooked up in the cores of the interiors of stars during the some 10 billions of years that have passed since that much earlier era.
When I turn on my HF rig, obviously a lot of the ambient noise I'm hearing is man-made and created by natural sources here on terra firma. Am I actually hearing some radio noise from space as well?
Yeah, you certainly are, particularly so at the lowest frequencies. I mentioned, I think, that the spectrum of variation of the amount of radio noise with respect to frequency has a negative spectral index. It varies in proportion to some negative power of the frequency. That means the lower you go in frequency, the stronger the noise is. On the 80-meter and even more so 160-meter bands, most of the background noise that you hear is, in fact, generated, as long as you're not getting local power line interference or ignition interference or something like that that you can recognize by its slightly non-random character. You're almost certainly hearing primarily background noise from the galaxy. It varies with time of the day, and it varies in such a way that highly directive receiving antennas on those bands are quite desirable, because at least at some times of the day, your antenna's reception pattern will not be optimized for the picking up of the galactic noise, and therefore it may be optimized for picking up DX signals that you're trying to hear and work. That's why separate receiving antennas on those low bands are often highly desirable, even though the efficiency of the antenna may not be very high. A beverage receiving antenna doesn't work, therefore, as a transmitting antenna very well at all, but it can be a huge advantage in receiving on those frequencies.
Now, a beverage antenna is quite close to the ground. What effect, then, does ground have regarding those low-spectrum noise sources?
Well, the effect of the ground causes the propagation velocity along the wire to be slightly different than the free space velocity, and that has to do with the directional characteristics of the antenna. But otherwise, the ground is not particularly important. And the ground temperature, only about 300 Kelvin, just sort of normal everyday temperatures of the Earth, are not high compared to the effective temperature of the radio noise that's being picked up by the antenna. So the ground noise is not a significant factor there. At very much higher frequencies, of course, up in the VHF and UHF regions, the 300 Kelvin ground noise may be quite significant, and indeed is probably, at least for parts of the day and in certain directions, may be in excess of the noise that you pick up from the sky. That's one of the reasons why hams who like getting into EME work, Earth, Moon, Earth, Moon bounce work, often build antennas which have sufficiently high directivity to reject the ground noise and can look primarily at the cold sky that is the background to the moon and the direction they're looking.
I've been speaking today with Nobel laureate Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, Dean of Faculty and Professor of Physics at Princeton University, recipient of the 1993 Nobel Prize for Physics for his work on pulsars. I'm Hap Holly, KSNRP, and this is the RAIN Report.
The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2010. RAIN, all rights reserved.